Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the Oakland Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, brought to you from the Lakeview Club, overlooking beautiful Lake Merritt in downtown Oakland. We also welcome the listeners on WOIAM in Ames, Iowa, one of the more than 225 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. I'm Connie Shapiro, a member of the Board of Directors of the Oakland Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce and a member of the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club of California. We invite all of our listeners here and on the radio to join the Commonwealth Club on the World Wide Web at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce James Filosky, Chairman of the Board of both the Summit Medical Center and the Oakland Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, who will introduce today's speakers.
Thank you, Connie. Today we bring to you two individuals with very diverse backgrounds, but also with a very strong passion for healthcare, not only in this community, but in the broader region. And I will give you a little bit of the written stuff. If I gave it to you all, we'd be listening to their long resumes rather than hearing them talk. Dr. David Lawrence was named Chief Executive Officer of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, Inc. and Kaiser Foundation Hospitals in 1991 and was named Chairman of the Board in 1992. Dr. Lawrence is a graduate of Amherst College, University of Kentucky for his MD, University of Washington for his MPH. He is a board certified in general preventative medicine at Johns Hopkins and the University of Washington. He is also currently sitting on the boards of Pacific Gas and Electric Company, Hewlett-Packard, the Bay Area Council, Raffles Medical Group of Singapore, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Hospital Research and Educational Trust. I've had the opportunity to sit on a number of efforts with David, and particularly with his efforts for the community here with the United Way. And it's very seldom do you get a true leader in a leadership position, and I've always appreciated that leadership. Edward Penhote, Dean of the School of Public Health and Professor of Public Health and Molecular and Cell Biology at the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Penhout is also a director and co-founder of Chiron Corporation, one of the world's leading biotechnology companies. Dr. Penhout served as Chiron's president and chief executive officer from the time he co-founded the company in 1981 until April 30th of 1998. In 1992, Dr. Penhout shared with Dr. William J. Reuter, a Chiron co-founder, the Northern California Entrepreneur of the Year Award presented by Ernst & Young and Inc. magazine. In 1994, they received jointly the Harvard School of Northern California Alumni Chapter Award as Entrepreneurs of the Year. A little known fact that Ed is born and raised in Oakland. And between these two, they have brought many strong activities in the nonprofit arena. You can always count on them for their support of this community, and we're glad to have them. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. It's a great pleasure to be here. David and I have decided to divide our presentation in two halves and to leave as much time as possible for dialogue with you. I'm going to present first an overview of new developments in technology and how the new technological developments are really pervasive in today's healthcare world. And then David will follow with a discussion of the challenges and opportunities in bringing new technology to consumers in the healthcare marketplace in both an effective and cost-effective manner. We live in an extraordinary era of new applications of technology to health. These new technology developments often come in on a regular basis, and in a sense, oftentimes as a result, where we don't really become fully aware of the total impact that new technology has had in healthcare. But I think it's safe to say that in today's medical practice, it's more rare than not that almost all of the techniques and the therapeutics which are utilized in medicine today didn't exist even 20 years ago. If you look where these things are coming from, they're coming from three major sectors in our economy, from the biotechnology industry, from the pharmaceutical industry, and from the device industry, all of which have experienced an extraordinary two decades, if you will, of contribution of new products to healthcare. Just to list a few from the area that I know best, which is biotechnology, we now have a safe blood supply in the United States, largely as a result of the development of tests that will detect HIV-infected blood or blood which is infected with all forms of hepatitis. We've been able to reduce the spread of hepatitis around the world by introduction of a new hepatitis B vaccine, which is today one of the most widely used vaccines in the entire planet. We've significantly lowered the risk of fatal heart attacks with a drug developed by my colleagues at Genentech in San Francisco, which dissolves blood clots in the heart. We've managed to slow the progression of multiple sclerosis through the widespread use of interferons, although not a cure, dramatically enhanced the lives of people with that disease. Biotechnology has developed growth hormone to allow dwarfs to achieve full stature. There are many new cancer therapies which have come to pass in the past couple of decades. We still don't have cures for many forms of cancer, but today we have more than 5 million Americans who are cancer patients, either cured or living with their disease. Tremendous progress in a variety of fronts. There are new arthritis treatments. We have much longer life for HIV patients, a spectacular development, as you may have seen. In fact, without biotechnology, if the AIDS epidemic would be almost unbelievable and uncontrollable influence in our society. If AIDS had come in 1950 instead of 1980, we would be virtually defenseless against this disease. And finally, we have many new opportunities to monitor disease status more effectively than ever with a variety of new tools that allow us to measure the health status of patients much more effectively than we ever did before. I'm sure many of you know people with diabetes, for example, who now can measure blood glucose very simply and easily many times a day and therefore control their diabetes much more effectively and have much more effective outcomes. So that's just from biotechnology and through and the other sectors as well, as you can go through the list, certainly in the device area. New hip replacement technology, new stents for improving blood circulation, new pacemakers for improving cardiovascular function. The list goes on and on and on. So we are in an era of explosive development of new technology. This will continue. This is not simply a bolus of new activity, which is going to decline now as a function of time, but probably the pace of the introduction of new technology in health will actually pick up. It's coming from a variety of sources. As you all know, the wellspring of biotechnology and healthcare research in this country is the National Institutes of Health, which fortunately has received substantial increases in funding in recent years, therefore driving a much larger enterprise of biomedical research within the academic community. And that community is really the place in which new knowledge applied to health is discovered, and that new knowledge eventually is turned into new products by the companies which are so closely affiliated with today's academic environment. It might be interesting to note, for example, the interest of young people in this field. those of us who are in it, of course, think health is the most interesting subject of all. But this interest is shared by young people. The most popular major at UC Berkeley now, by far, is molecular and cell biology. We have 1,400 undergraduate majors in molecular and cell biology. Most of those students have a serious interest in health. That's why they're involved in molecular and cell biology. The future outlook, therefore, is for continuation of not only new technology, but many changes in how healthcare is delivered as a result of the technological developments. There is an explosive development of new information now that's coming from the Human Genome Project. 10 years ago, it seemed an absurd notion that we would understand the entire genome of a human being. As we speak today, every human gene has now been tagged. And literally all of the genes will be sequenced within the next 18 months. So shortly after the turn of the millennium, we will have the complete sequence of a human, followed shortly thereafter by sequences of lots of humans, because people are beginning to try to understand disease processes by, in fact, optimizing care for each of us based on our own individual genetic fingerprint, if you will. But this technology is moving very rapidly. But advances come in this field not only from the techniques of molecular biology, but also from the techniques of information science and computer science. The role of the internet in healthcare is expanding dramatically every day. And one of the most important new factors in our society is the growing role of the consumer in making decisions about his or own their own health care and making informed decisions. The internet today is already the primary source of health information for most Americans. In fact, I'll take how many of you in this room have used the internet to look up a piece of health information for yourself, a friend, or a family member? It's a rare, for those of you who are not here in the room today, most people in the room just raised their hand. It is a very widespread phenomenon now. I'm sure David will comment upon this. Frequently, physicians today are faced with patients who come to their meetings with them, having diagnosed themselves over the internet. Frequently, when the physician disagrees with the diagnosis, they have quite a healthy argument over who's right about this situation. But the empowerment of the consumer through the technology of the internet and the information contained in it, I think, is another very powerful influence, which fundamentally is driven by new technology, that is, internet technology, but at the same time provides a completely different role and a changing role in the relationship between the medical community and the consumers of healthcare, the patients themselves. And both of these factors will lead to ultimately optimized healthcare for individuals. Individuals will be better informed. They will be better informed not only because they know more about their disease states from what they learn, but they will also know a lot more about themselves through genetic analysis. Each of us will have a deeper understanding of our own predilections and our own sensitivities and, quite frankly, our own the effectiveness of different kinds of therapies for our own diseases. This has already started. There is a new treatment for breast cancer, for example, developed at Genentech in South San Francisco, which is only useful on about a third of total breast cancers. And so it has no utility except for those patients who have a particular kind of breast cancer, which is identifiable only by molecular techniques. So this is, in a sense, the first wave of how genomic information is used to optimize medicine for individuals. So, David, with all of this onslaught of technology and consumer interest sort of being weaved together, I must say I'm glad I have my job and not yours.
With that, Ed, let me make a few comments. Ian Morrison, who used to be with the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, has a wonderful way of describing the situation in the United States and contrasting that situation with Scotland, where he was born, and Canada, where he was raised. Ian likes to say that in Scotland death is imminent, in Canada it's inevitable, and in the United States we think it's optional. I actually don't want to make light of the extraordinary breakthroughs and the extraordinary work that Ed describes. We now have the tools, as Ed indicated, to alter the course of life in many ways, and those tools will do nothing but expand. But just like trying to run the Sacramento River through a garden hose, what we're doing is trying to run the explosive new technologies through a very constrained delivery system. And I'd like to talk for a few moments about what it is that constrains that delivery system, what the issues are that we need to pay attention to, if you will, and then talk a bit about some of what we've learned that may help transfer the kinds of things that Ed is talking about into effective use for consumers. The two major constraints, the two issues that this country has yet to come to grips with, are first how to finance the extraordinary implications of the explosive technologies for the individual. And the second is to deliver those new technologies safely so that, in fact, they have the intended outcomes, the intended impact. Now, today, perhaps in the question and answer period, we can talk about, or in the dialogue period, we can talk about the financing issues, but they are extraordinary. Our discussion with the Department of Corporations last year over Viagra is but an example of the kinds of dialogues that we will be engaged in over what of these new technologies are going to be covered under which circumstances, and how in the world are we going to pay for them. But the other issue, which I'd like to just spend a few moments on, is the fact that that we have not, as a nation, spent enough time worrying about building a chassis for delivering these explosive technologies safely. In fact, one could argue that the chassis through which most of us will receive this technology, what I mean by that is the physician system, the hospital system, the outpatient structures, etc., is a chassis that has its roots in the 19th century and in many ways has changed little since then. It's a chassis that was built for a different time. It was built for a much more limited technology. It was built for a very restricted science, when the main thing that we could do as doctors was to provide care, caring, not science. The explosive advances since just before World War II, and really accelerating in the last decade or two, in fact, will be dwarfed by by the kinds of discoveries, the kinds of advances that Ed described. I view it as a tsunami. A kind of technological, biotechnological, and also communications and computing tsunami that we face in terms of trying to arrange the delivery system to deal with it. Let me just give you some facts that I think might startle you. I say these things, and I want to put one caveat around them. I say them not because I believe people are malicious or badly motivated or not struggling to do the very best thing. This is not a statement about people. It is a statement about structure. It is a statement about systems or non-systems. 75% of physicians are reported to not be able to apply, to not use currently available science in their practices. The third leading cause of death in the United States are accidents, intended and or not intended, but unintended accidents that occur as a result of either the misapplication of the technologies or because we don't fully understand the implications of the technologies. About one-third of the nation's health bill is estimated to be due to the costs of poor quality in the application of what we know and do. One-third, $335 billion, is the estimated cost of poor quality in health care. This is not about motivation. This is not about people being bad. It's about systems. It's about performance. Now, what's going on here? The medical care system, the health care system, is built on the premise of a single doc or a small cluster of doctors. Remember, 75% of physicians are still in solo or small group practices. It's built on that premise. And yet, to do many of the things that Ed is describing, to realize the full benefit of many of the surgical breakthroughs that we've established in the last two decades, to treat pediatric asthma or congestive heart failure, or to take full advantage of the breakthrough treatments for multiple sclerosis, requires a team of professionals. It requires an integrated capability of professionals and support systems and support structures. When you think about where you would go with a very serious illness, you don't think of an individual. You think of Mayo or Sloan Kettering or Fred Hutchinson or other kinds of institutional settings where, in fact, they have been able to assemble the capabilities of an integrated delivery system. And so what we are faced with is a delivery system that is structured for a different time and is struggling to keep up with the breakthroughs in science. It is imperative that we focus on how we transform the delivery system. Most of the public debate, even during the 1992-3-4 healthcare reform discussions, focused on financing, which is a significant issue. But little attention has been paid to the issue of safety and security and reliability in the way in which this science is delivered. Consider for a moment the contrast between the healthcare system and the aviation system. For 25 years, the aviation industry has focused, actually it's longer than that, has focused on building a track record of safety. It has taken them a long time of consistent work. The data are published. The near misses are studied carefully to understand how to avoid the problems. There are legal protections for those kinds of investigations to occur, and the result has been a dramatic and steady improvement in safety in the way in which we can fly from one part of the country to another. In medicine, we have refused to deal with that issue. We do not have public databases. We do not have safe harbors legally for carrying out those kinds of investigations, in fact, quite the contrary. Remember the debate just this year in the state legislature in this state. Sue them. If they mess up, sue them. That's appropriate for the consumer. We've got to protect the consumer. Well, protecting the consumer would be far more effective if we focused on safety and prevention than if we focused on the very occasional and very rare events that end up in a successful suit. The contrast between the medical care system approach and the aviation industry is very useful to understand where we can go with the healthcare industry to focus on improving safety. Now, I'll conclude my remarks by saying simply this: to be able to realize the full advantage of the extraordinary breakthroughs that Ed and his colleagues in the biotechnology field are bringing to the possibilities for human life and quality of life improvement, we have to put a similar amount of energy into transforming, experimenting, building new delivery systems that are robust enough to carry that extraordinarily precious cargo effectively. Only a handful of systems are robust enough at this point to carry that cargo. Steve Shortell, who now is at the school where Ed is dean, did some very, very important studies in the early part of the decade looking at the numbers of integrated, multi-professional, team-based delivery systems in the country. They are few and far between. In fact, you can count them on two hands. And yet we know that it is in those kinds of systems where the opportunities for safety improvement and for effective and reliable delivery of these new technologies are most likely to occur. We have to focus on the delivery system. It is not safe. And that is because it is a system issue. It is a system designed for another time, not to deal with the kind of science that we're now able to bring to patients.
Thank you, David. The issue of prevention, in a sense, is a broad-based issue. You mentioned one aspect, which is to prevent medical mistakes, if I might characterize them as such, by better systems within the delivery systems. But also, I think as a nation, we clearly often underspend on preventive healthcare and overemphasize technology as it applies to treatment of people who already have diseases rather than really investing. I was surprised recently myself when one of your contemporaries indicated that they didn't, in the health insurance or the health delivery systems, didn't feel it was a wise investment for them in prevention because people move too often and they'll spend a dollar today to make someone healthier 10 years from now, and by then they'll be in your plan instead of theirs. How do you think we can get to a stage where actually it makes sense for us as a society to put more money into prevention?
Well, there is a real curiosity with that. It's a good question. Actually, we do a lot of spending. Probably the highest level of spending in prevention is by buying guns to prevent ourselves from being blown away by criminals, right? Mm-hmm. I'm being facetious. We are quite willing to spend money in that. But that's sort of the ultimate perversity in terms of the misuse of prevention thinking. But that's a personal bias. We could expunge that from the record. But in fact, I think the issue of how we finance preventive services is critical. I know in our organization, in Kaiser Permanente, we have a very stable patient population. People tend to stay with us for their lives, really. And in that case, we've made a very, very strong and long-standing commitment to the issue of investing in prevention, which really consists of early detection of disease, prevention of it in the first place, but early detection so we can keep the adverse effects from occurring downstream, and then, of course, very effective or trying to be very effective in rehabilitation once disease has occurred. So we invest very heavily in that. I have heard that same argument from others in the field. It is an insurance argument. If you have an unstable population, that is to say a population turning over over a period of time, within a relatively short period of time, it does not pay from a financing point of view to make the investment in prevention because that's a long-term investment. That's part of what I meant by the problems we have in the current way we finance healthcare.
Well, I see a number of questions have been gathered by our hostess, so it's probably time, Connie Shapiro, for you to rejoin us and to allow us to address some of the questions you have there.
Thank you very much to both of you. We do have a number of questions, and in most cases we will ask that both of you respond, although in some instances perhaps just one of you will do so. Americans never cease to tell pollsters that health care is one of the most pressing issues facing the nation today. But our political leaders, especially at the national level, seem unable to address the issue. How would each of you assess the political climate vis-a-vis healthcare?
At this point, it's entirely reactive. After the debacle of the 92-93 national healthcare reform effort, most of the people with whom we talk are so bruised and still so scarred from what happened in that fight that they're only willing to deal with healthcare reform at the margin or in incremental ways. It's very reactive at this point. Moreover, it is focused entirely on the issue of financing, not on reforming or rebuilding the chassis of American healthcare delivery. It is almost entirely a financing debate to the extent it's occurring at all. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some important things being considered. Healthcare insurance and access to healthcare for children, for example, and expectant mothers, or continuing debates over care and provision of drugs and therapies for the elderly. Those are important pieces of the debate, but in typical fashion at this point, given what happened in the 92-93 period, it is very, very fragmented and an isolated kind of issue that people are willing to rally around if they rally at all at this point.
Thank you, Dr. Lawrence.
This is Ed Penn. I think also there has been a response at the federal level to the demand, or if you call it the tsunami, of new technology in the sense that the one federal agency which has received significant new funding in the last few years is the National Institutes of Health.
Right.
In large part, I think, due to the successful programs that the NIH has spawned in developing new technology and the ease with which voters, if you will, can identify the products of that technology and obviously understand the relevance of those products to their own lives. So it's a simpler problem in some ways.
Yeah, everybody will vote favorably for the promise of a better life.
Yeah.
A survey this summer by the Kaiser Family Foundation which I know is not directly associated with Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, found that 87% of doctors claimed that HMOs had denied their patients some type of coverage in the past 2 years. Is the denial of coverage as bad as this statistic suggests?
First of all, I think there is some real confusion about whether or not that was that is, in fact, in practice, valid. That was what physicians say. But remember, physicians, especially the AMA, have voted to unionize. Mm-hmm. I take with a grain of salt what it is that the practicing physicians are saying about the way HMOs are interfering or not with their practices. Often, the confusion is between what a benefit package and benefit interpretation will permit by contractual agreement with the patient or with the purchaser of that benefit package and interference with a clinical decision by a physician. The American Association of Health Plans claims that that kind of interference occurs rarely. In our system, in Kaiser Permanente, for example, and we've been criticized along with everybody else about this, there's simply no question about it. The doctor makes the decision either by himself or in collaboration with his or her colleagues. It is a physician-driven set of decisions about what happens to patients. That's the way it should be. It has to be that.
Well, I think this is a subset of the broader issue of cost and effectiveness. You know, many people have argued that one of the principal drivers of the economic miracle in the United States in the last 5 years has been the dramatic decrease in the inflation rates in health care. It's provided huge sums of money that can be invested in other parts of our economy. And, you know, we're still faced with this very deep tension between how much is available in terms of new technology and how much we can afford as a society. It's not, in a sense, a bridgeable gap for society. As a collection of individuals, when faced with the reality of a very serious disease, we will spend any amount of money to effect a cure. In fact, a systematic study of how much money Americans are willing to invest when they're faced with the serious disease is basically they will invest all their money. Okay, so the economic price tag Americans place on their lives is about $5 million. It means most of us can't afford to save ourselves. But nevertheless, it's a huge amount of money. So the problem we face is that as a collection of individuals, we're willing to spend an astronomical amount of money. But as a society trying to cope with what's an appropriate amount of money to spend on health care, we couldn't agree that the aggregate of 5 million times the number of people in the U.S. would be a thinkable approach to this problem. And oftentimes, for example, physicians will suggest generic equivalents of drugs as being less expensive. Some patients might view that as, well, you know, I see the ads for whatever it is that they would prefer to have, but the evidence is that the generic alternative is a quite acceptable one. And so there's this gap between oftentimes patient knowledge. Maybe exacerbated by the new empowerment of consumers with the internet-based and other sources of information.
Yes, could I just say one more thing, Connie? We have to be very careful about this notion of whether or not there's enough money in the system to be able to pay for many of the new technologies. Some argue that there is, and the argument goes like this. If you look at the Institute of Medicine's recent studies on the quality of health care in the United States, after a 3-year study, they concluded that the quality of health care in the United States was both the best in the world and the worst in the world, and the trouble is most of us don't know when we're getting which. It's a random walk. It is a severe problem of overuse, misuse, and underuse. Overuse is using an antibiotic for a viral infection. Misuse is using the wrong antibiotic. And underuse is not using an antibiotic when it's indicated, for example. Now, when you combine all those costs based on what we currently know, that's where the number of about a third of $1 trillion in the costs of poor quality come from. It's from that coupled with how we organize healthcare in its highly redundant, highly expensive, fragmented way. Now, you take $335 billion a year and direct it to some of the extraordinary new technologies and capabilities that actually impact on the quality of life and life expectancy, you have some capability to finance before you run up against the wall of trying to decide who gets it and who doesn't. the whole question of rationing. We have a long way to go before we should be debating that as the central issue.
That leads into the next question. Is health care a right or a privilege?
Well, it's a right in this country for only one segment of our population. Does anybody know what that segment is? People who are incarcerated in prison have a right to health care. They're the only people in this society by That's law right. who have a right to health care. And I think it's more than a semantic argument. And, you know, I think everyone would agree at another level outside the law that there is a basic human right to equitable treatment when it comes to health. And certainly in our society, as fragmented as our health care delivery systems are, virtually all people still somehow or another with serious medical problems end up being treated in our society, but it's a very difficult issue. But by the law, there's incarcerated individuals are the only people with a right to health care services.
In those countries in which the answer to the question is yes, it is a right, and those countries are trying to build an equitable distribution of access to medical care through their financing mechanisms. Interestingly enough, like us, most of them are struggling. You either see long queues and, in effect, rationing based on age or worthiness on the one hand, or you see it in terms of differential ways in which the health care is delivered, even though it's financed equitably. So the variations occur quite markedly across the world in how they have tried to effectively deal with an assumption in their legal structure that health care is a right. There is no panacea here.
In the early 90s, polls indicated about 83% of Americans were satisfied with their health plans. The government wanted to meddle with this. Now, no one seems satisfied. Fat profits go to corporate expectations, not at all concerned with patient-physician caregiving. And now, the much-touted HMOs need to be policed, which adds more costs. Is this all a case of more government meddles, the worse it gets?
There are a couple of arguments. The first is that you could say that one of the decisions that emerged from the failure to achieve effective health care reform was essentially throwing the health care delivery system and financing system onto the open market, where all of the patchwork regulatory agencies and governing agencies each take a bite. Remember, in Kaiser Permanente, for example, to do our business day in and day out, we have to deal with over 100 regulating, accrediting, and licensing bodies across the country. We have to deal with over 2,000 pieces of healthcare legislation in 1999 alone, potential pieces of legislation. And we have to deal with 111,000 pages of Medicare rules, regulations, guidelines, and protocols. So many people thought that, in fact, healthcare reform would simplify what is an already horrendously overregulated and irrationally regulated industry on the delivery and financing side. So I don't know that you could draw the conclusion that it's more government meddling making it worse. It was bad in the 90s, believe me, before healthcare reform. It is acceleratingly more difficult since the failure of healthcare reform, because we now have everybody sort of focused on healthcare and passing legislation at local levels, state levels, and some at the federal level. It's become a blizzard.
Can you both comment on the potential effects of the new Patients' Bill of Rights that awaits the governor's signature?
Can you go ahead on that? Yeah, first of all, you know, I'm not deeply familiar myself with the details of the legislation which is there, but I think it does, as I understand it, effectively deal with patients' rights to second opinion, which, you know, if we take David's comment about 75% of physicians being incapable of dealing with many of the new technologies, probably second opinions are a wise thing, and I think that even within the best-managed organizations, frequently second opinions are valued among colleagues who are worried about the best care for their patients. And The issue that patients would have the right under certain circumstances to litigate if they were wronged by an organization, you know, I think is a right which is, exists throughout our economy, and it's not clear to me why the healthcare system should be immune in any in a particular way from those kinds of activities on the part of patients who are truly wronged by willful act or otherwise. So, you know, I think for the most part, it is responsive to patient concerns. I think that it's it probably defines a reasonable path forward, which wouldn't impose unnecessary burdens on those trying to deliver health care in a quality and cost-effective way, but nevertheless provides a level of assurance to patients that they have recourse outside the system that they're involved in.
I agree completely, Ed. And let me just add a couple of things. I think where we ended up in the state of California actually is quite remarkable considering where we started at the beginning of the legislative session. Some of us participated in a legislative retreat early in the year, and I was stunned by how vituperative the language was about health care and about managed care and HMOs and insurance companies and doctors and hospitals. I mean, it was really quite astounding to listen to the legislators talk about how angry they were in reflection of what their constituents were saying. I was quite worried about this year's state legislature, and I think it's a real testimony to the leadership in the legislature and also to Gray Davis and his staff, that they were able to forge a patient bill of rights approach that is moderate, reasoned, balanced, and given the environment in which we're operating, I think a pretty amazing outcome for the reasons that Ed described. The place that we're still quite worried, it didn't turn out too badly this year, but it's going to be a debate that keeps coming back, has to do with the mandates for specific diseases or for specific conditions. Turning the ability to get access to care into a political battle, those people with renal failure or those people with this illness or that illness, and making that decision based on how effectively those people can access the political process is exactly the wrong way to structure a healthcare financing and delivery system. It's quite worrisome. It's very, very inflationary. Fortunately, we didn't see too much of that impact this year.
And that leads to the next question, and that is, can society afford the amount of health care we're demanding through the patient's Bill of Rights and other movements that are similar?
If these costs are added on to the current costs of delivering health care, the answer is clearly no. No amount of cost shifting onto the individual consumer by the purchasers is going to create the financial wherewithal to handle the cost of care as it's emerging, given the new technologies, given all of the things that we can do and so forth. Only with a careful attention and reform of and transformation of the delivery system side of things, which gobble up so much money in their inefficiencies and the unpredictable quality, will we be able to have a shot at affording to being able to pay for many of the new technologies that Ed described? We've got to do both. There's not enough money in the world to cover the costs of what we now are able to do unless we make sure it's delivered in a more efficient and effective way and high quality way.
Excuse me. Thank you. Okay. How likely is it that the advances that you spoke of, Dr. Penhote, will provide significant relief to the health care crisis in the third world, especially Africa?
This is a very difficult issue. If you remember some of the or most of the items that I listed as major breakthroughs from the biotechnology field, et cetera, they're mostly directed at diseases largely of people of advanced age in the last third of their lives, if you will. They're high-tech in their nature for the most part and really not applicable to third-world countries. And we live today in part due to the Internet, again, in a world which is shrinking very rapidly and where people all over the world now know what the state of the art for medical care is because they can log on to Medline, Health Central, DrCoop.com, whether you live in Africa or in Alameda. And so there's no doubt that there's a growing tension, not only within the U.S., but globally, about priorities for health. and to be frank, fair amount of resentment in third world countries about the amount of money we're willing to spend on ourselves in this country for high-tech medicine applied particularly for the last few months of life, this lack of inevitability of death that we seem to live with in this country. And there unfortunately isn't substantial investment today in new technologies applicable in the third world. So, because the financial equation of the investment, the returns on those investments at the moment are modest, and healthcare companies, like all other companies, don't survive very long unless they make a significant or have the prospects, at least, for significant levels of profitability. And, you know, we at Chiron, for example, spent $150 million trying to develop an AIDS vaccine, in part because we thought that it would be a commercial success in the developed world, but also in part because it would make a big contribution to a global problem of great import. You know, in retrospect, it's turned out to be a very difficult undertaking, and at the moment, very few companies are now investing in AIDS vaccines simply because the difficulty of the task is so large and the probability of success is so small, and the market opportunities are questionable. But in Africa, HIV is a devastating phenomenon. And, you know, as a society, I think we have a responsibility to begin to address some of these problems in the third world. It's a vexing problem for us, to be sure, but there are no easy solutions to this problem right around the corner.
One of the promising activities, actually, is, I agree completely with that, is in dealing with what are called the so-called orphan diseases, diseases for which there is not an economic rationale for inventing the technologies that will help them be ameliorated. AIDS now, because of the of what's happened in the developed world, is no longer receiving the same level of attention and investment that it once was. However, it is essentially viral genocide in the third world in some forms. It's just devastating whole populations in many parts of Africa in the third world. To try and combat that, groups like the Gates Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation and several others have actually formed a consortium to start to finance investment in these orphan diseases. There are a number of them. There is not an economic rationale for dealing with them. There is an extraordinary human rationale for investing in the development of these capabilities. The problem has been money. Now that the Gates Foundation is funded at $17 billion or whatever it is, it's just an extraordinary amount. They have identified worldwide disease eradication in these orphan diseases as one of their primary focuses. One of the advisors to the Gates Foundation, interestingly enough, is Bill Foege, Dr. Bill Foege, formerly head of the CDC, a person who was personally led the team that eradicated smallpox from the world, was honored by the School of Public Health at Berkeley several years ago as a public health hero for his work. But he is advising the Gates Foundation, and he sits on the Rockefeller Foundation board. And he's been instrumental in helping pull together this consortium, along with many others, this consortium that is funding investigation and development of treatments and new technological breakthroughs for these orphan diseases in the third world.
Well, and it's, I think, a particularly important movement that people from outside healthcare are now beginning to take responsibility. It's never been clear to me why Chiron ought to have more responsibility for HIV control in Africa than General Motors does. It's a societal obligation, in a way, to the third world.
Yeah.
And the healthcare companies alone can't bear this entire burden.
Yeah.
And so, you know, broadening this responsibility on society, I think, is a very positive thing. The U.S. government is also beginning to take some first steps toward being more active itself. The National Institutes of Health has set up a new vaccine division of NIH to develop new vaccine technology, recognizing that for many third world diseases, it's not something that the commercial world in this country can easily afford to do on their own because of the dynamics of the investment returns that are possible in that sector. So there is a new NIH vaccine initiative. NIH is funding local vaccine initiatives, and a number of those are now going on here in the Bay Area, for example. So there is more government involvement in trying to do something as well.
Thank you. What will be the impact of the aging of the baby boomer generation on healthcare, on the healthcare delivery system?
Well, baby boomers have had it their way their whole lives. I know I am one. It's been hard to be wrong about where society is going, and if you just look around what the baby boomers are doing. They're going to spend until the cows come home, as the saying goes, to maintain their health status. I don't think there's any doubt about that. So I think there will be tremendous pressure from baby boomers to maintain their position in the world. You know, they really literally have been in charge since 1965 as a group. They took control as teenagers, and they've kept the control the entire time. I think that they're going to go down kicking and screaming, I suspect. So I think as a group, they're going to be the biggest single factor in driving for more health related products as they begin to age. You may have a different view, David, I'm not sure, but you deal with us every day in your organization.
No, I think actually one of the very healthy things, notwithstanding the fact that you and I are part of that generation, Ed, the very healthy thing about this is it's going to put enormous pressure on both the financing side and the healthcare delivery side to get with it. And what I mean by that is if you're a healthy elderly person, you are going to spend a lot of time and money focusing on maintaining your health, preventing illness, maintaining vibrancy in your older life. The medical care system certainly is not set up to respond to that particularly well. It's not interested in that. It hasn't historically been focused on that. As you move into chronic illness or into the frail elderly status as you age, the healthcare system, again, is not well organized to deal with those realities, to deal safely and effectively with prevention, with early identification, early intervention, instead of intervening at the late stage of an illness when huge costs are incurred, maintaining you in the last few months of life, etc. And then, of course, there's the tremendously important part of helping people deal with the transition from life to death, the late stage of living, hospice care, the kind of effective dealing with saying goodbye, the effective dealing with letting go. Our institutions are not set up to do that. I suspect, at least at this point, in general across the country, there are many who are doing it well, but it isn't the norm. And what I think will happen is this baby boom pushes up against the realities of the way healthcare is financed and delivered and organized in its current form, is that they are going to force changes in that, in both sides. And that actually will be salutary, I think.
How will you deal with the fact that an increasing number of people with no health insurance or care?
When I mentioned what I did earlier about the failure of national health reform and the throwing out onto the open market of the entire insurance and health financing industry, one of the very sad consequences has been a rapid acceleration in the number of people who are either uninsured or underinsured. In the absence of clear guidelines about how you underwrite and how you charge and what groups you have to include and who you don't in your insuring process, it is a natural consequence of a very, very aggressive insurance industry to seek out the very best health risks and to try and avoid those who are expensive, read that, unhealthy, sick. And one of the things that's the consequence of that is that you see the fragmenting of the risk pools and the growing numbers of people who are uninsured. It is a frightening specter, frankly, and it is something that will be unsustainable at the point that those numbers include fairly large numbers of employed people who would be in what we call the middle class. And that those numbers are increasing. The middle class, or the classes that sort of together make up the large middle ground of American society, are the ones who drive the political debate or will drive the political debate on this. As long as it's focused on the poor and the disenfranchised, we've been able to ignore it as a social problem and have very effectively over a long period of time with only incremental changes with Medicaid and other special targeted programs. It is a very grave problem for our country.
One of our major initiatives today in the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley actually is to work with a number of organizations to empower the underserved in our society with better information. An informed consumer is a more active consumer, and is more likely to get care from whatever systems exist today to provide that care. It's a hodgepodge of circumstances. One thing we know for sure, however, the delivery systems of the country can no longer be expected to provide health care to people without compensation. Local hospitals simply can't afford to do it. I was recently chairman of the Institute of Medicine Commission on organ allocation in this country. So we heard lots of testimony from all the transplant centers around the country about how people get on the waiting list for organ transplantation. We were told by every one of them, you don't get on a waiting list unless you prearrange the financing for this, because we cannot afford the cost of providing free transplant services to any person in society. That era of, to some degree, Robin Hood medicine is simply doesn't exist anymore in our society. But I think that, you know, if you look at the truly underserved, there are actually reasonably effective governmental programs today. Medi-Cal works reasonably well, but oftentimes they lack the information required. People who could be serviced by that organization lack the information required to get themselves into the system. So there are a number of attempts now going on to actually include the underserved in our society much more effectively, and about the best way to do it in our society is, in fact, to empower them with more information. So there are lots of initiatives. I see my colleagues from Cisco Systems here in the room. There are lots of initiatives now underway to close what's called the digital gap, generally to empower people throughout our society to with information available on the web. Certainly the digital gap in health is a big problem, and there's a lot of activity now aimed at trying to do this.
Let me just make a comment about that. I actually don't agree with you, Ed, about that. I don't think information is the issue. I think effectively bringing together information, communications technologies, the biotechnologies, the self-monitoring capabilities that are being developed for patients alone or in their homes with their family, a variety of tools brought together to create a very different delivery capability that builds on some of what we have now, hospitals, doctors, et cetera, but adds the capability of computing power, of distance consultation power, of distance monitoring, et cetera. All of those, facilitated by the Internet, represent some hope, frankly, for the uninsured and underinsured, as well as for many of us in healthcare, for a very different way in which healthcare is organized and delivered. It goes well beyond knowledge, although knowledge is a critical element of that. I really see the advantage or the promise of the communications, the computing, the internet, and the biotechnology tsunami that we're faced with as offering us the opportunity to reframe the way in which healthcare is organized and delivered at a much, substantially, much lower cost and much more reliability and consistency.
Well, I don't disagree with your statement, David, but the first step for any consumer getting health care is knowledge that it exists and Right. Where to go. And frequently that is lacking in our most underserved Absolutely. Populations. If you look around the world at the determinants of health generally, and you ask, what is the most important single determinant of health globally? It's income. Okay, you give people more money, they get healthier on their own. They spend some of it on their health, they are more aware, et cetera. Tackling redistribution of income in this country is not probably something I want to work on. It's an issue which goes far beyond my capabilities. But if you look at the second most important aspect of improving people's health, it is access to information so that it empowers themselves to go and participate. And so I think it's at that level, but I certainly don't disagree that interest in health on these people's part, kindled by information available to them, will allow them to actually participate in this coalition that you talk about.
Unfortunately, we've arrived at the time in our program where we have an opportunity for just one more question. As technology progresses faster and faster, how will our ethical thinking keep pace? How will we handle the knowledge we're acquiring about, say, the human genome and cloning?
Go ahead.
This is an extremely important issue. Clearly, genomic information has the ability to empower us individually and us as a society to understand ourselves much better, to frame better treatments, to, in fact, carry out much better prevention programs if we know what our susceptibilities are, et cetera. So it has great potential for good. It also has great potential for harm. As David just indicated, one of the maxims of insurance is try to get as good a population as you possibly can as your customer base, because the cost in doing so will be less. If insurers began to use genetic information to discriminate against individuals based on the probabilities that they will end up with an incurable or very difficult, expensive disease, then it would be a misuse of genetic information. And so the right to privacy with genetic information is an extremely important issue. But I think one of the things we have to do is keep a balanced view of this, because we might be so concerned about privacy that we, in fact, deny ourselves all the benefit of genetic information. The broader issues really relate to gene therapy, for example, in the germline. Should we, in some sense, take control of our own destiny as a species by permanently curing gene defects in individuals and for their progeny essentially forever? This is an ethical issue which is, you know, fortunately not upon us today, but where many people are beginning to put some very hard thought into this problem so that we can make sensible decisions for ourselves going forward.
Just a couple of comments. There's some work underway now to try and address the ethical issues that are being raised by current technology and the anticipated technology. We have a National Advisory Council on organizational and clinical and professional ethics, made up primarily of outside people who are helping us with some of the dilemmas we face as an organization. And there are numerous efforts across the country to try and address this, either out of the academic world or out of some of the foundation and institutional world. There's an interesting nexus here, and Ed triggered it for me, that we have to be very thoughtful about. The more information we have about individuals and their likelihood of disease, the more perverse the current financing system results will be because of the incentive to do exactly what Ed described. We and many others who have our roots in the 1940s and 50s still believe very deeply in the concept that the risk of bearing a disease, or risk of having a disease, and the costs associated with that is a societal risk. One should not be punished for the sins of one's parents and grandparents and genetic line back through time. But essentially, experience rating does that. We believe very deeply in community rating, which essentially says we're all in this together. And if you happen to have had a bad genetic draw, either historically or now because of what we can understand molecularly, you're not going to be punished for that. The current insurance system will punish people for that. It does now, and it will continue to do so until it's changed.
Thank you both very, very much for a most provocative discussion this morning. On behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California and the Oakland Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, I want to thank both Dr. Ed Penhote, Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and Dr. David Lawrence, CEO of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, for joining us today. We also thank all of our listeners, both here and on the radio, and we look forward to seeing you at some of our upcoming programs in the East Bay and in San Francisco. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, is adjourned.